6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Fax, the trade station. Number 1, High Ash Farm, Caistor, St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
Colin Walters, Managing Director of Manchester's Piccadilly Radio, temporarily joined the editorial staff of The Guardian earlier this week in an article entitled Cinderellas of the Air. With a skill born of decades of political manoeuvring, the BBC has gained the initiative in the long-running debate on radio development. In the spring, the government published a green paper on radio, which seemed to indicate an increasingly substantial future for the commercial operators. They, in turn, responded warmly and felt their fate under an enterprise-oriented government was secure. But now the BBC is coming up with a range of imaginative plans for its radio services that have been skillfully devised to conform neatly with forward government thinking, while allowing the corporation to retain its dominant position in the medium. With alacrity, the BBC has leapt in to support the government's tentative thoughts on single-frequency radio. After decades of BBC simulcasting, the transmission of the same service on both medium wave and VHF, the practice is now condemned as wasteful. It is to be stopped. Conveniently, its end will allow the BBC to increase its national channels from 4 to 6. It plans to run radios 1, 2, 3 and 4 on VHF only, but create a sport and education network on 1 AM frequency and add a public affairs network where radio 4 is now on long wave. The distress that will be suffered by devoted medium wave BBC listeners who, without a VHF radio, will be unable to find their favourites is predictable. Of course, the BBC reckons that most dispossessed listeners will simply buy new VHF sets and become more sophisticated in their listening habits. If they're right, the corporation with this ingenious reorganisation could secure its domination of radio for a decade or more. There are no signs of any reaction from the commercial operators. Maybe their recently relaxed posture results from the almost unprecedented prosperity they currently enjoy. The industry, which a year ago felt itself the Cinderella of the media world, poor and unloved, has been feeling decidedly chipper. This view is almost certainly misguided and complacent. The government, having perhaps for the first time in a decade put some real intellectual sweat into exploring policy for radio, is once again preoccupied with TV and the challenges it offers. In the Home Office, a new Minister of State needs to be convinced that radio matters to many millions of voters, that commercially funded radio can thrive in a deregulated setting and can provide a vigorous service totally relevant to the needs of the 90s and not trapped by the ethos of either Reith or Radio Caroline. The IBA, in spite of being rattled by the government's threat to rob it of control of radio, shows little sign of coming up with a sort of innovative thinking that would perhaps persuade government of its ability to do the job in a more liberal context. Action is necessary if the BBC's unhealthy domination of British radio is not to continue indefinitely. First, the government should immediately indicate that it will consider proposals for total frequency splits by established independent radio, IR, contractors. Currently, all independent radio stations, like the BBC, broadcast the same service simultaneously on FM and AM. Many larger IR companies have wanted for some time to set up totally different services on their two frequencies, dramatically widening the choice available to local listeners. Second, the BBC should be told to do the same with its larger local stations, which also simulcast. If it will not or cannot, the government should make it clear those frequencies will be removed and offered to independent contractors. Third, the government should use the copyright bill currently going through Parliament to break the stranglehold of the major record companies on airplay of their product. Stations effectively promote the sale of pop discs by playing them on air, thus contributing substantially to record companies' profits. Yet they're forced to pay exorbitant royalties for the privilege. An 8-year legal battle has failed so far to help the radio industry. Fourth, the IBA must come to terms with the new radio world by conducting a more open debate on the finance of its services. For years, it has assembled and evaded over the costs of its radio operation and the criteria by which it sets rental levels. Some questions urgently need answers. What are the precise costs of its purely regulatory function? What are costs of providing and operating transmitters for each station? What is the exact level of cross-subsidy that enables small stations like Moray Firth in Inverness or Wyvern in Herefordshire to pay minuscule rentals? What alternatives are available that would allow a service to listeners in lightly populated areas while the big urban stations are not financially punished? Fifth, speed up the process bringing commercial national radio to Britain, as the Green Paper suggests. Local contractors who have opposed this for fear of losing national advertising revenue must surely think again. The strength of our broadcasting system, and possibly even our democracy, rests on reasonably fair broadcasting competition. It is in nobody's interest for the BBC to be allowed to maintain its long-standing ascendancy in radio. Until a more balanced structure has been devised and underpinned by legislation, an active effort must be made to avoid the BBC developing preponderant power. And that was a comment by Colin Walters, Managing Director of Manchester's Piccadilly Radio, in this week's Guardian.
From Broadcast Systems Engineering, FM broadcasting in the USA. James Wood examines the early history of frequency-modulated broadcasting in the US and lists some of the manufacturers of broadcast FM transmitters. Frequency-modulated sound broadcasting's roots lie in the United States. It began in the mid-30s, nearly 20 years before FM broadcasting got underway in Europe. There was good reason for this. Unlike Great Britain, where under direction of the government, the Engineer-in-Chief of the Post Office issued licences only to the British Broadcasting Corporation, the United States Authority, the FCC, permitted commercial broadcasting. In fact, all broadcasting in the United States came under private enterprise. In such an atmosphere, the US forged ahead in many new spheres of technology, leaving Great Britain and Europe behind. Most applied research and development is sponsored by huge manufacturing companies who are reluctant to invest in new technologies if a future market cannot be guaranteed. And that was the situation that faced many European companies at that time who were involved in the business of manufacturing receivers and transmitters. It is a common misconception to think that most worthwhile inventions in radio came about in the UK. In the case of FM broadcasting, much of the research work was done in the United States. One of the pioneers was E.H. Armstrong, and it was his system that was adopted in the US. By the year 1938, the FCC had assigned some 200 channels with 200 kHz spacing for FM broadcasting in the band from 42 to 50 MHz. Even in those early days, the US had several companies in the field of radio broadcasting, possibly the most famous of these being Western Electric, General Electric, and the Radio Corporation of America, RCA. By the late 30s, these companies, with others, were producing FM transmitters and receivers. One of the first examples of FM transmitters was the Western Electric 503A1. This was a 1 kilowatt output transmitter that employed the so-called synchronous FM system, which used a motor-driven oscillator to compare the mean carrier frequency to a precision frequency standard. The difference frequency so derived was then used as a servo input for mechanically retuning the oscillator frequency to an exact multiple of the standard. Another example of a high-power FM transmitter was the RCA type RCA50A. A 50 kilowatt output transmitter using a chain of frequency multipliers to achieve the final output frequency. There were other companies of a more humble stature in the United States that are now credited as pioneers in the field of FM broadcasting. One of these was Itel McCulloch in California, IMAC. Itel McCulloch was formed in 1933 by two radio amateurs. In searching for radio transmitting tubes, they found that no commercial manufacturer produced a transmitter tube that would operate with 1,000 volts plate supply, a voltage that the radio amateur regarded as high. By the year 1934, William Itel and Jack McCulloch had developed a tube that was to revolutionise the amateur and the professional transmitter markets. This tube was called simply the 150T. It was a high-performance triode suitable for high-frequency use, and in the years that followed, IMAC produced a whole new range of such triodes. In late 1935, IMAC was honoured with the US Naval Research Contract to supply tubes for experimental work on 200 MHz, a very high frequency in those days. With its reputation established, IMAC became involved in developing tubes for FM transmitters. The popularity of IMAC tubes grew to such an extent that by 1940 it was making tubes for Western Electric, and its first big war order was for no less than 10,000 tubes. Today, the IMAC company is Varian IMAC, a division of Varian Associates, not only the largest tube manufacturer in the States, but the largest tube manufacturer in the world. Varian IMAC tubes drive transmitters all over the world, ranging from VLF, LF, MF, HF high-power transmitters through to VHF and UHF TV. Not unnaturally, their tubes are specified by most US transmitter manufacturers. More transmitter manufacturers reside in the US than in any other country in the world. The broadcast division of the giant Harris Corporation is located in Quincy, Illinois. They claim to be the largest volume manufacturer of broadcast transmitters in the USA. Transmitter products cover the entire frequency spectrum: LF, MF, HF, VHF FM, VHF TV, UHF TV. Continental Electronics Manufacturing Company is a division of Varian Associates, Inc. Continental is an engineering-oriented company specializing in design and manufacture of low, medium, and high-power transmitters for ELF, LF, MF, HF, and VHFM, FFM, etc., but not including TV transmitters. Continental transmitters are used throughout the world by commercial, military, and government radio stations for local, regional, and international broadcasting. Broadcast Electronics, Inc., also in Quincy, Illinois, restrict their activities to areas in which they lead. These include mixers, cart machines, studio automation systems, and radio transmitters. At the top of this range of FM transmitters is the FM-35A, a most impressive 35 kilowatts, one-tube FM transmitter, a formidable contender worldwide. For 25 years, CCA Electronics Corporation of Fairburn, Georgia, have specialised in building transmitters for MF, HF and VHF FM applications. Design philosophy is based upon battleship-type construction and incorporating such design features as grounded grid techniques to guarantee long life coupled with reliability and ease of maintenance. Acrodyne Industries of Bluebell, Pennsylvania, have established a reputation for their range of television transmitters. Though Acrodyne manufactures VHF and UHF transmitters, these do not include transmitters for FM broadcasting at present. Elcom Bauer market their VHF FM transmitters all over the world. Elcom Bauer design and manufacture AM and FM transmitters, but not television transmitters. Television Technology Corporation, Wilkinson Radio, manufacture TV and FM translators and low-power television transmitters, along with a standard range of transmitter accessories. Marti Electronics, Inc. of Cleburne, Texas, have to date confined their activities to the manufacture of FM radio links in the frequency range from 140 MHz to 960 MHz. These are intended for use in remote broadcasts and electronic news gathering systems. EMCEE Broadcast Products, Whitehaven, Pennsylvania, confine their activities to manufacturing UHF-VHF television transmitters up to 10 kilowatts, also UHF-VHF television translators and microwave repeaters up to 3 gigahertz. From this summarized overview of the US transmitter manufacturing industry, it will be seen that only about 50% compete in the FM transmitter market. Some companies are not sufficiently large to be able to spread their resources over the entire broadcasting spectrum, from LF to UHF. Others, such as Comark, one of the leading television transmitter companies in the US, owe their position as leaders in UHF transmitter technology to the fact that they have not diversified. There are companies that recognize their inability to compete on price in the highly competitive market for VHF FM transmitters. Finally, there are the giant companies such as Harris and Continental, who compete in all spheres of transmitter technology, ranging from very high-power AM transmitters for LF, MF and HF applications to medium and low-power transmitters for the very high frequencies.
And in last Sunday's Observer, it was reported that Douglas Hurd has agreed to an ITV meeting. Home Secretary Douglas Hurd has bowed to pressure from the ITV Association and last week agreed to a meeting on the 14th of April to discuss the government's proposed policy changes on broadcasting in general and the auctioning of franchises in particular, wrote Alan Lee. 4 weeks after it was revealed that the government would award future franchises by competitive tender, heads of ITV companies have now moved from outright rejection of the plans to proposals on how they may be implemented with the least damaging effects. They're pushing ahead with cost-cutting measures to increase competitiveness ahead of the 1992 franchise awards. At the heart of the change is the need for ITV companies to be more competitive. London Weekend Television is tackling this problem head-on with its decision last week to pare down staffing levels. Brokers Kleinwort Grieveson thinks LWT could add £9 million to its profits if the package is successfully implemented. According to a report from National Economic Research Associates, ITV companies could lose £550 million annually by the end of the century if no cost-cutting measures are introduced.
From The Nation, Thailand's independent newspaper. Legitimate users of radio transceivers need help. The crackdown on the illegal use of radio transceivers initiated by Government House last week is widely believed to be politically motivated. Aides to the Premier felt that it was time to do some house cleaning to get rid of people who have taken undue advantage of the Premier's generosity and tolerance. It is an open secret that a growing number of people are illegally using the transceivers. Authorities say more than 90% of people using this modern walkie-talkie radios bought the equipment in the black market and used them without a proper permit. The transceiver is a preferred means of communication because it is much more handy and efficient than a telephone. It is also much cheaper than any portable cellular radio phone. A large number of people, including police officers, public disaster relief volunteers, and members of the mass media, use the transceivers for legitimate purposes. Unfortunately, many people who have no legitimate need for the transceivers also acquired the equipment to show it off, to impress people around them. Thus, we often see people carrying their transceivers into supermarkets, food shops, and department stores, and intentionally leaving the switch on. The intermittent crackling radio message attracts attention of passers-by, who tend to think that people carrying the equipment must either be senior police officers or government officials. The transceivers became a status symbol of the show-offs. Many paid a fee to be members of a foundation on the promotion of Thai culture, which was based in Government House. They received a membership card issued by an aide to the chief advisor of the Premier, authorising them to operate transceivers via a radio network of the foundation. The radio network has since been closed, and the aide to the chief advisor was barred from entering Government House. Perhaps those most seriously affected in the crackdown are public disaster relief volunteers of private charity foundations, such as the Poor Tek Tung and Ruam Kantanyu. Volunteers from these two foundations have virtually replaced the police in picking up bodies of accident and murder victims and sending injured people to hospital. They are also instrumental in helping the fire brigade put out small fires in crowded neighbourhoods inaccessible to large fire engines. These volunteers, like members of the mass media and police officers, used to rely on news coming to them on the transceivers. Without the equipment, these people are virtually cut off. The Post and Telegraph Department does make provision for people who have legitimate need to apply for permission to use the transceivers. But many still find some of the conditions set by the department unacceptable. For example, all transceivers must be handed over to the department as government property. Those bought in the black market would not be accepted. A monthly user fee is levied. The transceivers must be fixed to receive only a few frequencies. Those having the capability to scan for communication on various frequencies are banned because they can be used in eavesdropping on communications of the police and other government agencies. And indeed, many did just that. The crackdown may have been well intended, but it inadvertently opened a Pandora's box. We hope the government will relax the conditions in applying for permission to use the transceivers, because many people do need the equipment for legitimate purposes. The police department, for example, is planning to ask the government to legalise the use of transceivers by its police officers. Meanwhile, the police and firemen will likely have to work harder because not many volunteers would be able to go to their help in time. That from The Nation, Thailand's independent newspaper.
Thank you.
Broadcasting to the European Community, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Fax, the trade station. Number 1, High Ash Farm, K-Store St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
In the Times this week, Maggie Brown reported that Carlton and Virgin are to bid for a national radio franchise. Two of Britain's fastest expanding media companies, Carlton Communications and Virgin, are planning to bid for the first of three franchises to run Britain's new national commercial radio stations. This follows a go-ahead by Douglas Hurd, the Home Secretary, on Tuesday. Michael Green, head of Carlton Communications, said, "I'm very interested. Radio is an incredibly cheap way of reaching people in terms of the cost of programming and equipment. We're looking at either bidding by ourselves or going in with someone else. It should be a perfectly viable business." Robert Devereux, the chairman of Virgin Television, a subsidiary of Virgin Group, said, "We're definitely bidding. We've always thought radio was a local extension for us. The group will not necessarily wish to devise a pure music channel, however, and it is looking at information programmes as well. We've recently bought stakes in two independent local radio stations, Radio Mercury and Radio Piccadilly, to learn about the business," added Mr. Devereux. While the costs involved remain a mystery, the pricing method of the new quasi-monopoly rights to broadcast and raise advertising on three new national channels is seen as crucial. Mr. Devereux said, "Our business plan will look at what is spent by advertisers in the market and see if we can calculate our share of national advertising. Programming costs are much easier to assess." Brown Maddox, media assistant at Kleinwort Greaveson, said, "The value would be low, despite the attraction of holding a national radio advertising franchise for the first time and the Home Secretary's commitment to introduce the three in a sequence." She added, "If they are really going for three new channels, there will be very little money around." She expects existing commercial radio stations to be badly squeezed, with about 10 out of the 46 stations either going under or being bought out once the explosion begins in 1990. Miss Maddox said the Australian Paul Ramsay Group, which invested heavily in local radio during 1986, was trying to sell up, including its 25% stake in Capital Radio. Nigel Walmsley, Managing Director of Capital Radio, said the Home Secretary's decision to look for diverse programming was quirky. He said Capital, whose IBA contract for London runs until 1992, thought a franchise would be worthwhile and was very interested, and he would seek an involvement.
This next report from Roger Tate.
Audio News, presented by Roger Tate. And first the headlines. Yamaha are to release a new range of cassette decks. Ariston are to release a new amplifier. News from Partington Stands, Revox and the BBC. Laskys are to support digital audio tape. As predicted widely, Yamaha have recently released several new cassette decks. The popular K340 has been replaced by a new model called the KX300, priced at around £149 in the UK, whilst the K540 is now superseded by the KX500 at £209. Both of these models feature Dolby HX Pro, as well as logic control, manual fine bias, and an optional infrared remote. One rather unusual facility is playback trim, a control that gives a small amount of treble lift to improve tapes made on decks where bias or azimuth were out of adjustment. More on this when we run a full review. The Scottish turntable manufacturer Ariston have surprised the hi-fi trade with the unveiling of their first integrated amplifier. Initially, it's going to be called the Pulsar. The new amplifier is described as being a freshly styled unit, sporting a black Perspex fascia and a high-tech look. rated at 40 watts per channel, the real surprise is that the amplifier comes complete with an infrared remote and is expected to sell at a remarkably low price, around £175. Facilities include tone controls, video auxiliary inputs, moving magnet and moving coil record deck inputs, as well as inputs for CD and tape. Partington loudspeaker stands have just announced a new Dreadnought stand, made of heavy steel and standing some 38 centimetres tall. Now, these heavy stands are supplied with floor spikes, top spikes being an optional extra. The stands can easily be filled with sand, and Partington are offering the Dreadnoughts filled with a mixture of lead, sand and resin. Now, when carried into our studio by a friend of mine, the comment was, "Heavy, man." Priced at £129 filled, I would say these stands are certainly for the weightlifting hi-fi buff. And now a couple of rather short items. News now from Revox. Revox have just published a lavish 40-page colour booklet to commemorate the firm's 40th anniversary. If you'd like a free copy, then drop David Wood a line at the British Importers, who are FWO Bausch Limited of 49 Theobald Street, Boreham Wood, Hertfordshire in the United Kingdom. News now from the British Broadcasting Corporation. The BBC have completed their work on the RDS Radio Data System network ahead of schedule. The central RDS computer should go online next month, with the official launch of RDS being later this year. And our final item. Laskys are to support digital audio tape. Laskys looks set to be the first high street retailer to stock DAT machines and pre-recorded tapes. The Laskys hi-fi chain have acquired 12 special display units and a limited selection of DAT titles from the German label Grossmeister. It appears that DAT will at first be restricted to 12 of Laskys' top outlets, who will be able to offer 10 titles, retailing at £14.99. Meanwhile, both Sony and Technics are refusing to announce a firm release date for DAT machines in the UK. This has been Audio News with Roger Tate.
In The Independent on the 28th of March, there was a report on the survey of the Milky Way. The most detailed survey of the Milky Way started last week at the Very Large Array Radioscope, a set of 27 antennae dishes, each about 80 feet in diameter, that move on 20 miles of tracks in the New Mexico desert. The $1 million two-year survey will be conducted by Robert H. Becker, Associate Professor of Astronomy at the University of California's Davis Campus, and David Heflund of Columbia University. The survey will consist of maps of 70% of the Milky Way visible from the northern hemisphere by detecting objects that emit radio waves which penetrate the dust. Becker and Helfand will have 300 hours of viewing time. They will spend another year or two using computers to construct maps using the detected radio signals.
From Electronic Times, recording subtitles. Video recorders do not record teletext subtitles, which has been causing a lot of frustration among deaf people who need to keep the subtitles with the TV material they record. So Nufax, a Bristol teletext company, has designed an adapter that puts the subtitles back onto the recordings. Due to bandwidth restrictions, the video blanking interval is not recorded on VCRs, so the teletext information is lost, said David Richer, Managing Director of Nufax. Our decoder takes the signal, decodes a teletext signal, and recreates it as a picture, in a picture, so that it can be recorded. It is a new generation adapter based on the latest Mallard 6230 Euro teletext chip.
Another person giving his comments this week was Tony Curry in The Guardian. The article was entitled Elegant Solutions or Space Spaghetti. If your local newsagent, he said, had only four different newspapers and no magazines for sale, no one would dispute that there was something very far wrong. yet until now the British have tolerated a broadcasting system as narrow as that. Plurality is the keynote of the future for television and radio, an end to the occasions when choice means three channels of sport and the fourth screening a decrepit foreign movie. But at the first sniff of competition, the broadcasting establishment has become complacent, narrow-minded, arrogant and needlessly short-sighted about their cosy duopoly. They do not seem to realise that the status quo is no longer an option. The public has an insatiable thirst for ever more television, and technology has removed almost all the obstacles in the path of multi-channel services, whether via cable or by less other elegant devices. Within 20 years, our present one-way television system will seem as old-fashioned as 2LO and the crystal set of the 20s does today. Anyone who has something positive to offer shouldn't be denied the right to disseminate their ideas by means of sounds or pictures. Advertisers, too, must be able to shop around instead of being restricted to the ITV and ILR monopolies in their areas. The unexploited market for advertising will never surface, given only Hobson's choice. The local fish and chip shop owner may well spend a few quid on community radio, for example, when he knows he's not wasting cash talking to folk too far away to be customers. Community radio must be encouraged. It can be simply a one enthusiast and his tape recorder affair. It can equally be an affiliate to one of the largest town's commercial stations. An affiliate catering for the far-flung small communities of the Inner Hebrides could be viable if it had a commercial relationship with Glasgow's Radio Clyde, to borrow an example from the 1977 Annan report. Community radio can be a self-supporting 24-hour-day station, catering for the inhabitants of a wider but still sparsely populated area, like the Welsh Valleys or the Scottish Highlands. Several Green Paper proposals should be enacted forthwith. An end to the Luddite practice of transmitting the same programme on several frequencies will create space for new stations. An end to the IBA's monopoly in the provision of over-sophisticated transmission facilities could allow the commercial sector the option of setting up its own cooperative for the purchase and operation of such facilities. National networks need not be confined to television. The low profile of radios and advertising medium will be raised by two or three nationwide commercial outlets. The BBC has already seen the potential for an increase in radio choice with its plans for additional domestic services and the transmission of its excellent taxpayer-funded world service within the UK, a move long overdue. In television, Channel 4, hailed in its infancy as a disaster by the press and now suddenly as its favourite son, should be allowed to grow up and leave home with due dignity. It has been tied to ITV's purse strings long enough, and when the ITV companies no longer have to pick up the tab for one of their rival channels, the equally ridiculous practice of Scottish ITV companies subsidising the Welsh fourth channel should cease. Just because Scotland's Gaelic speakers have not resorted to violence or hunger strikes to blackmail government into getting their own channel, they shouldn't be denied it. The Scots SC4 contributions could go at least some way towards parity with the rest of the Celtic diapause. Of course, none of this can be achieved by a broadcasting bill or bills that says, in effect, do as you please. Those who talk of deregulation have plucked the wrong word from their funk and wagnalls. A re-regulation is the real buzzword. Anarchy in any form serves no one's interests. There has to be some kind of framework within which freedom can function. The system the cable authority applies to its charges is a workable example of light-touch regulation, which is nonetheless effective in preventing the worst excesses of violence, pornography or sponsorship from dominating cable operators. And programme providers alike have already demonstrated their cooperation and responsibility. Superior means of transmission, like cable, where whole channels can be locked out by parents, for instance, can ease the load of responsibility for those who have to establish parameters of taste and decency. The recently touted idea of a terrestrial fifth channel doesn't deserve support. There's something retrograde about the notion when cable, with its fully interactive capabilities and almost unlimited capacity, seems the neatest bet for the future. Instead of funding more terrestrial transmitters, we should be helping cable get into the ground and looking at ways of creating a national infrastructure to deliver vision, sound and data to and from houses, schools, hospitals, hotels, shops, offices and factories from Lizard Point to Lerwick. Building tiny local microwave transmitters to deliver a handful of extra channels to a few thousand homes at a time, the equally fashionable MMDS, seems a technically inferior proposition, as does direct broadcast satellite. The prospect of filling the back gardens and window boxes of Britain with upturned soup bowls tied with spaghetti to a bewildering conglomeration of set-top boxes necessary to detect, unscramble, polarise and retune the incredible minute signals from outer space. Cable can get you whatever's up there, as well as local channels, domestic and business communication, and even the humble telephone, freed from the sealing wax and string technology in which it still stagnates in the very city of London. There will always be a place for Coronation Street, Newsnight and the Arches, but there's also room for so much more from both local communities and broadcasters as far apart as Atlanta and Moscow. Why should we be denied choice any longer? Well, that was a view from Tony Curry, who is controller of programmes for the Cable Authority, and he's also Scottish. And that was reported in this week's Guardian.
This is Technical Radio, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Facts, the trade station, number 1, High Ash Farm, Caistor St Edmund, England, NR148RH. From the IBA's Engineering Bulletin, ITV transmitter re-engineering. Many existing high-power ITV transmitters have now been in service for more than 17 years. As transmitters age, there is an increased maintenance requirement which gives rise to an increase in labour costs and components needed to run the transmitters. More importantly, there are benefits to be gained by using modern and more efficient equipment. These factors have led to the decision to replace the ITV transmitters at a number of stations over the next few years, and the IBA has ordered replacements for 14 of the existing high-powered transmitters. Improvements in design have led to a significant reduction in the size of transmitters, and two sets of modern transmitters in parallel operation can fit into the space at present occupied by one set of the older transmitters. This means the new equipment can be installed without major building alterations. During the installation period, one set of the old transmitters is removed to make room for the two sets of replacement transmitters. A temporary transmitter connected in parallel with the remaining set of old equipment will maintain service with little or no reduction in power. The temporary transmitter is in a portable cabin and is left outside the main transmitter building. In this way, new transmitters are installed at leisure, without the viewer even noticing, and then the transportable unit is moved on to another site. Since the first UHF high-power ITV transmitters were commissioned in 1969, there have been design improvements which can substantially reduce electricity costs. The original pairs of 25-kilowatt parallel-operated transmitters have a power consumption of 250 kVA. The consumption of the new transmitters will be only 140 kVA, a saving of more than 40%, and a considerable reduction in operating costs. The major factor in the improved efficiency is the design of the Klystron power amplifier. In the existing ITV transmitters, some nearly 20 years old, the Klystrons operate at a typical efficiency of 28%. The fourth channel transmitters, brought into service in November 1982, have efficiencies of more than 40%, but the new equipment, using pulsed techniques with the black level close to saturated power level, will offer efficiencies of more than 60%. The first of the 14 new transmitters is being installed soon at Mendip, closely followed by Pontop Pike and Emly Moor. At the rate of about 6 installations per year, the first phase of re-engineering is due for completion by mid-1990. After all the first phase of 14 stations, we expect that work will continue to replace all the existing ITV main transmitters. The new transmitters will have one other major advantage. Additional circuitry can easily be added to allow the transmission of digital stereo sound to the NICAM specification agreed between the BBC and IBA. In parallel with all that, new transposers are being installed at dozens of the old relay stations throughout the country. It is very much a vote of confidence in the terrestrial network and a real commitment to that network for the next few decades.
Raymond Snoddy reported in this week's Financial Times in an article entitled Music Royalties Investigated. The government has ordered the Monopolies and Mergers Commission to investigate royalties charged by copyright bodies for the broadcasting of music. The commission will also consider needle time, which is the restrictions placed on broadcasters on the amount of time they can devote to recorded music. A joint reference to the Commission by the Department of Trade and Industry and the Home Office follows complaints by local commercial radio stations that royalties charged for playing records on the air are too high and that needle time restrictions will hamper independent radio's growth. The investigation was announced by Lord Young, the Trade and Industry Secretary, in a written answer to a House of Lords question. It will consider how the owners of copyright in sound recordings assign their copyright to a collective licensing body, which then sets conditions for its use. The issue of royalty charges and needle time is becoming an increasingly important because of government plans to ease regulations on UK commercial radio ventures and to create three national commercial channels and several hundred local and community stations. In spite of Home Office determination that there should be diversity of programming, particularly on the new national channels, recorded music will inevitably form an important part of the total output. Although the Commission has been asked to look at the collective licensing of public performance and broadcasting rights in sound recording generally, it is believed the main target is Phonographic Performance Limited. Most record companies hand their broadcasting rights in music to PPL, which then issues licences in return for royalties. It's the second time this week that the government has called for a Monopolies Commission investigation under the 1973 Fair Trading Act. On Monday, it announced that labour practices within the film and television industries were to be scrutinised. Lord Young said yesterday's reference was part of the government's general concern over uncompetitive practices. A report is expected by the middle of October.
We're on the air to demonstrate the kind of service we will be providing every day of the week, starting during the summer. What we are seeking is a licence to transmit from the United Kingdom, instead of hiring transmission facilities abroad. If you would like our specially printed QSL card, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, Number 1, High Ash Farm, Case Store St Edmund, England, NR14 8RH. And don't forget that every letter we receive helps our application for a licence to transmit from England. From The Guardian, Thursday, March the 31st. Oil Giants Pump Rivals, by John Hooper, Energy Correspondent. Motorists who fill up at the service stations of one particular oil company because they think its petrol is different or better are more likely than not buying fuel produced by a rival firm. The chief executive of BP Oil, Mr. David Kendall, yesterday told MPs that 60 to 70% of the petrol sold under BP's brand name came from its competitors' refineries. The House of Commons Trade and Industry Select Committee had earlier heard about the exchanges among big oil companies from the firm whose proud slogan is, "You can be sure of Shell." Senior executives of the Anglo-Dutch giant said they could reduce transport and other costs by taking supplies from another company if its refinery was nearer. Shell marketing strategy relies, to a much greater extent than those of its competitors, on emphasising the supposedly unique qualities of its petrol. That strategy suffered a serious setback this year when Formula Shell had to be withdrawn after engine damage reports. In evidence to the committee, Mr. Jaap Kluutwijk, Managing Director of Shell UK, said that what was exchanged was basic petrol. Additives were then introduced into all the petrol sold under the Shell brand name, using Shell facilities built at their rivals' refineries. Mr. Kluutwijk said that the petrol swapped among companies had to conform to British standards. But he readily agreed with Labour's Dr. John Gilbert that Shell refineries produced a better fuel. Dr. Gilbert then said that Shell, when it provided customers with petrol from another firm's refinery, was supplying them with an inferior product. Mr. Kludveich said that the difference would be small. He denied allegations that Shell had used commercial threats to prevent undercutting.
And a report by Mary Fagan in The Times about British Telecom's fight to join the cable television ranks. British Telecom is fighting for the right to provide entertainment services such as cable television over its fibre optic network. BT will be spending up to £20 billion over the next few years in installing local optical fibre networks connecting subscribers to local telephone exchanges and through to existing fibre trunk network. Under the conditions of its licence, BT cannot provide lucrative entertainment services over this network. The monomode optical fibre, as it's called, can carry 20 million hertz of bandwidth, although advances in the development of the fibres need to be matched by the devices that generate, receive and process the light signals it carries. The fibre will be able to accommodate signals for voice and data and other services such as television. BT's point is that unless its licence is changed to enable it to carry entertainment services, it will slow the rate of installing the technology because of the enormous cost. This will deprive the public of the interest in quality and reliability which the new network is supposed to bring to BT's telephone services. The quality of service, or lack of it, has spawned much debate in recent months. The company maintains that customers making just a few calls a day will not provide the return on investment BT needs, but these customers will probably be more than willing to pay for entertainment services. BT says that its capital investment would also, in effect, be subsidising entertainment operators on the fibre optic network. The government has set up a committee under Alistair MacDonald, an Undersecretary at the Department of Trade and Industry, to look at infrastructure and issues involved in the future of local fibre networks. The committee also includes people in the CATV business, the Chief Scientific Advisor to the government, John Fairclough, and Professor Brian Carsberg, head of the industry watchdog Ofttel. According to Ron Back, a BT corporate director, BT has told the committee that the expected investment of between £8 billion and £20 billion for the cabling of Britain is, I quote, a little big even for BT. If we're forbidden to provide television over that main network, then it will slow down how quickly we put fibre into the local loop network, unquote. If the US allows telephone network operators to provide television over the telephone network, a whole industry will emerge from the components needed to give joint services. Making the necessary devices in volume for the US market will bring prices down. If the UK doesn't follow this lead, the technical standards and the devices for the UK services are likely to be different, missing the cost advantage of high-volume production.
In the following item broadcast on Radio 4's Kaleidoscope programme, this week David Roper reports on how technology is influencing radio programmes in Sounds Possible.
Radio was once the medium of the microphone and the dinner-jacketed newsreader. Now, in a studio like the one I'm sitting in, you're more likely to find computers, microchips and voice synthesizers. Even at the BBC, we have the technology. In fact, we've had it since 1957, when the first broadcast was made using experimental radiophonic effects, what the French then called musique concrète, sounds of machines, typewriters, aeroplanes, all recorded on tape and mixed up together to make a kind of music. So unusual were the sounds produced that when the third programme broadcast Private Dreams and Public Nightmares 30 years ago, they prefaced it with a health warning from producer Donald McQuinney.
It's a sort of modern magic. Many of you may be familiar with it. They've been exploiting it on the continent for years. But strangely enough, we've held aloof, partly through distrust. Is it simply a new toy? We're saying at last that we think there's something in it. But we aren't calling it musique concrète. In fact, we've decided not to use the word music at all. We are interested in its application to radio writing, adding a new dimension, a form which is essentially radio.
Round and round like a wind from the ground, deep and deep, a world turns in sleep.
I fall through nothing, vast empty spaces, darkness and the pulse of my life bound, intertwined with the pulse of the dark world. Still falling, but slower now.
In those days, it was a matter of fiddling with the speed control on a couple of tape recorders and using an echo chamber. The whole process took weeks. But the success of the final result led to the establishment of the BBC's Radiophonic Workshop, best known, of course, for the Daleks. Richard Attree works at the Radiophonic Studios. But what exactly is radiophonic?
The creative use of sound, really, and what used to take, say, a week of tape editing and splicing can now be done, I should think, in about a morning.
And just yesterday morning, that very creative use of sound was demonstrated to me by a very public broadcaster, Mr. Kenneth Everett. Looking around this impressive studio in the middle of your Kensington home, one gets the impression that it needs a sophisticated mind to operate machinery like this.
Well, I've been doing it for so long, it's like driving a car. I suppose if you stuck an Aborigine in a BMW, they'd feel the way you do about this place, but I could sort of do it in my sleep now. Every button is at arm's length, and my fingers automatically go to the right one, not like they used to, but it is, it's like driving a car.
Well, just take us round from left to right or right to left.
OK. Where would you like to start? On the left? Right, this is a tape machine. It's a sort of a heavy-duty thing that lasts forever. It's called a studio made in Switzerland, and there's another one beside it. And we just toss sound from backwards and forwards from one to the other and do harmonies. I mean, you could sound like a chorus or an orchestra. Because I used to be a choir boy, you know. So I know which notes to hit. And with having two tape machines, you can bung your voice on one, then play that into the other one whilst adding another voice, and you can get jingles like this.
Dear God in heaven, please let this show go okay, with no major boobs or goofs, or is it goofs?
So that's your simple harmonies, but there's no machines used in that. The machines over here, on the right here, there's a thing that you can twiddle it to get rid of the bass and bung up the treble and all, make yourself sound all woolly or peculiar like that, you see. Back to normal. And this Japanese thing that I bought last year, the Yamaha Rev 5, costs approximately the Earth, but it does anything you like with your voice. For instance, you can just have normal digital echo until you disappear in the depths of the cosmos. Or you can have pitch change just by pressing a button here. You used to have to use tape to do this, but now they've got chips. So you just have to go like this, and it changes your voice in an upwardly direction like that. Or you can bung it down and sound terribly botch. Or if you're listening in stereo, you just press pan, and it can bung your voice like around the room. And as fast as you like. If you're listening in mono, this won't mean a thing, but if you're listening in stereo, it'll sound very peculiar indeed.
Then there's good old-fashioned delay.
Or you can flange yourself, if you'll pardon the expression.
Stereo phasing's rather a good one, too.
Well, you can sound like you're in a small metal box.
When you put together a radio show, it must be a lot easier to be like Simon Bates and put records on. Why did you go for radiophonics?
Because I thought I might as well do something that would make them want to employ me a lot. And if you just say, well, that was a great record, wasn't it? And here's another one. They sort of tend to think that you're replaceable, you know. But if you do something out of the ordinary, I think they ask you to come back. In between firing you, of course.
So what's the rest of the equipment do here?
Well, over there we have a thing called the vocoder. To put it in simple terms, you bung a record in one end and your voice in the other end, and you come out sounding like a talking orchestra. Like, for instance, I have a record here on turntable 93, and it's rather a spectacular bit of Vaughan Williams. Just fade that up. That's the actual record, and you can hear my actual voice, and if you bung them both into the vocoder,
it comes out sounding something like this.
Pretty amazing, huh? Similar techniques, though for a very different kind of programme, are also being used at Capital Radio by Peter Simmons. He's a producer with a background in electronic classical music, but came to Radiophonics to make a very serious and moving documentary called Breakdown, featuring two real sufferers talking about mental illness. Phasing and sampling were both used to recreate their painful experiences.
I was working with a lot of journalists and getting very frustrated at just doing the normal cut and cue technique pieces that journalists put out, and realised that the technology that I was hearing in the pop genre could be used in journalist-type pieces, in telling people stories, in illustrating them. And that's what we did eventually in Breakdown, when Mike was experiencing the start of his breakdown and he went down into the tube. He suddenly heard the voices of the passengers on the train come alive. What we did was had a group of actors. We took a line of each of the things he remembered hearing in his head, like, I'm going to kill you, I hate you. We sampled, i.e. recorded each of those. We put them into various machines, and then we played them back over the recorded sound of a tube train clattering along. The regular rhythm of the tube train becomes the voices out of the people that Mike experiences.
I'm trying to be a normal person. I'm not doing very well. I'm heading for Finsbury Park. I don't live in Finsbury Park. And I'm getting into a cold sweat. Where on earth am I going? I can't actually remember where I live.
Apart from the spoken choruses, there are musical passages in Peter Simmons' documentaries which all come from one note sung by a girl, then repeated at any pitch by a computer. The latest radiophonic workshop production is doing much the same at the moment. Producer Michael Wakelin is making The Dream, an impressionistic rock oratorio about Martin Luther King, and it's being broadcast this Sunday on Radio 1.
The music that's in the charts, a lot of it is the computer-based music. And the techniques used by the people that are producing the popular records at the moment, a lot of those techniques have been used in creating the songs that we've made.
I will go out with you and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. With this faith, we will be able to achieve this new day. When all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing with the Negroes in the spiritual of all.
Where exactly does this fit into radio? Are you pushing back the frontiers? Are you trying to make a different kind of documentary, a more, let's say, the kind of documentary which is for the pop age?
I think that, yeah, we really are wanting to do that. I mean, one of the aims of the programme was to introduce Martin Luther King to the Radio 1 audience. It is going to be an impression piece. It has to flow, and we've concentrated on the flow, and the way the archive sections and the songs, the way they run into each other has been very carefully thought about so that you are taken from one bit to another and it leads on.
The Dream is being created in a minute bunker of a studio by Richard Attree.
That's sampling him. This is the opening of the piece. The layers in this, we've got a basic rhythm track, right? If I start off playing you the... Okay, that's a bass drum playing. And this is the snare. This is the drum machine played by the computer. Then the other drums. So that's the basic rhythm. And then there's bass. Fairly jolly bass line playing away. Then chords on this big piano I was telling about. Play that on its own. You can hear how massive a sound it is. Huge, big piano made of 8 pianos. Okay.
I've never seen the human hand, this piano.
Yeah. It's 8 pianists all playing together. Right. Now, on top of that, we actually have Martin Luther King's voice. I took all of the versions that, where he says, I have a dream, and fitted them with this rhythm in various ways.
I have a dream, 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 dream.
That's what he sounds like on his own. Now, if I put him against the rhythm...
I have a dream. I have a dream.
But would you say you were a musician, a composer, or a computer expert?
All three, I should think, probably. And my first bit of work I did at university was computer science. I did do quite a lot of training as a pianist, but the types of articulation and the types of rhythm, etc., that I want are much too difficult for me to play. So I do a very rough version of it, and then I tidy it up myself on the screen, on the computer. But for me, it goes a lot further than that, using something like this computer. You're potentially able to make music which you not only couldn't have played, but perhaps couldn't even have imagined.
You're going to have a racial explosion. You're going to have a racial explosion. Explosion. You're going to have a racial explosion. You're going to have a racial explosion. Racial explosion.
One of Richard Attree's techniques is to take archive recordings of famous speakers such as Malcolm X there, Orion Paisley, Ronald Reagan, then create music from their speech rhythms. It's almost exactly what classical composers like Luciano Berio and John Cage were doing on European radio stations in the 1950s. Which makes one wonder whether in fact we've only just caught up with 30 years of innovation. Peter Simmons again.
Radio in this country has been dominated, A, by journalists, and B, by dramatists. And I think that the type of audio imagination that they can use has been restricted to their fields. I think this will change. I think as engineers become producers especially, and as people become much more aware of the technology and hopefully that they use the radiophonic workshop and use all the equipment in their studios, that dramatists can see that this equipment can free them and can make radio the best imaginative medium, as opposed to the runner-up to television.
Is there anything the technology doesn't yet do that you want it to do?
I think it's very hard to imagine what the technology can do until you've seen the new bit of technology. But every time a new thing comes out, I think, God, the possibilities of this.
Peter Simmons there, ending Sounds Possible, a report by David Roper on the technology of sound. The Dream will be broadcast on Radio 1 on Easter Day.
And that was from Radio 4's Kaleidoscope programme this week. This is Radio Facts, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. Radio Facts, the trade station, number 1, High Ash Farm, Caistor, St Edmund, England, NR14 8RH.
A report by Peter Riddell, the political editor of the Financial Times, on the DTI advertising budget being queried. The Treasury has formally questioned the scale and effectiveness of the sharp increase in the Department of Trade and Industry's advertising budget. Mr. John Major, Chief Secretary to the Treasury, has written to Lord Young, Trade and Industry Secretary, on the issue, and the letter has been circulated around other departments, producing comment from other ministers. The DTI has been unable to say what its advertising budget will be in the coming financial year, and Mr. Major's action suggests that agreement has not yet been reached. The Treasury is mainly concerned with the scale of the current DTI campaign on value for money grounds. Other ministers say its aim is to limit the growth of the DTI's advertising and promotion budget. This is expected to total £13 million in the 1987-88 financial year just ending, mainly incurred in the last few months, which is as much as in the previous 5 years combined. The highly unusual Treasury intervention in the marketing policies of a department comes at a time of growing parliamentary concern over the DTI's high-profile television and press advertising campaign. The Commons Public Accounts Committee is considering whether to ask the National Audit Office to hold an investigation, and Mr. Tony Blair, Labour's trade spokesman, has argued that the advertisements breach the Independent Broadcasting Authority guidelines on impartiality and party propaganda. The main DTI advertising campaigns have been on the Enterprise Initiative, the Action for Cities programme, and the drive to increase business awareness of the creation of the European Internal Market in 1992. Lord Young justifies such expenditure by the need to reach out beyond Parliament directly to business, given his previous successful experience with the Action for Jobs programme. The television and newspaper advertisements for the Enterprise Initiative have apparently generated 50,000 inquiries since January into various aspects such as design, consultancy, services. But a number of MPs and ministers are concerned both about the scale of the advertising and whether its content goes beyond previous Whitehall conventions about being informative rather than propagandist.
And one of the results of the marketing advertising budget, rather, is the highly informative report the DTI produces for the financial year 1986-87 on the activities of Radio Communications Division of the Department of Trade and Industry. One extract under the heading Television and Sound Radio Broadcasting. The Home Office has responsibility for broadcasting policy and is the licensing authority for broadcasting, but is advised by Radio Communications Division on technical issues, in particular on frequency matters. Community radio. Following the government's announcement in June 1986 that it would not proceed with its earlier intention to license a number of community radio stations for a two-year experimental period, the Home Office published a green paper, Radio, Choices and Opportunities, HMSO, price £5, in February 1987, inviting comments on the future of radio services in the UK. Radio Communications Division provided the technical detail for this green paper, which shows how the additional VHF spectrum, which will become progressively available from 1990, together with that at present available, could be deployed in a variety of uses to permit additional national and local radio services, together with a large number of low-power community radio stations. Special Event Radio. In January 1986, the government announced a two-year experiment in low-power radio systems for special events of a short duration, such as sports meetings and festivals. Up to 25 licences are available each year and may be used for periods of up to 3 weeks. Radio Communications Division identified suitable frequencies, drew up technical conditions for licence applicants, and is responsible for on-site checking for compliance with the technical conditions of the licence throughout the experiment. The future of special event radio is considered in the green paper on radio referred to earlier. New National Radio Networks. Following the Home Secretary's announcement in 1985 that two new national radio networks were to be made available at the beginning of 1990, Radio Communications Division has been involved in discussions with the BBC and the Directorate of Telecommunications in the Home Office on the timing of the former's move into the frequency band 97.6 to 99.8 MHz, currently occupied by police and fire services. The government announced in 1986 that the first new national network, 97.6 to 99.8 MHz, would be made available for the BBC for VHF transmissions of radios 1 and 2. No decision has yet been made on the allocation of the second national network, 99.9 to 102 MHz. But if it were to be made available for a national commercial radio service, it would be subject to the government's preliminary view, set out in the Green Paper, that all commercial radio, whether national or local, should be freed from the normal obligations of public service broadcasting and should instead be subject to a lighter regulatory regime. Additionally, Radio Communications Division is having discussions with the BBC, IBA and the Civil Aviation Authority on the compatibility of the new VHF plan with the aeronautical radio navigation services, which operate in an adjacent band above 108 MHz, and has initiated discussions with other administrations on how best to coordinate broadcasting use to protect the aeronautical services. Coverage improvements. Television. Almost the entire population can now enjoy good quality colour television reception from BBC One and BBC Two, ITV and Channel 4, or S4C in Wales. However, there are still pockets of population where for various reasons good quality reception is not possible. To meet the needs of such pockets where more than 200 people are involved, the BBC and IBA continue to be committed to a programme of investing in new transmitters. Radio Communications Division approved the BBC and IBA's plans for 40 relay stations during the year. Communities with fewer than 200 people which cannot get good reception are now permitted to install their own self-help transmitters to relay BBC One and BBC Two, ITV and Channel 4. Radio Communications Division approved the installation of 28 such self-help stations during the year. Coverage improvements. Radio. The BBC National Radio Networks, radios 1, 2, 3 and 4, are investing in additional transmitters to reach a higher proportion of the population. BBC Local Radio and Independent Local Radio are both expanding geographically and therefore more transmitters are essential. In all, Radio Communications Division gave approval for 18 extra sound broadcasting transmitters during this year. The 1984 Planning Conference in Geneva produced a new plan for VHF radio, which is gradually being implemented. It involves some stations changing frequency, and Radio Communications Division approved some 200 frequency changes in accordance with the new plan. Frequencies for programme making. Discussions continued between Radio Communications Division and the BBC and IBA on the terms under which, for the first time, the broadcasters themselves would be given responsibility for managing, through the Joint Frequency Management Group, the pool of frequencies made available for their use in making outside broadcasts and other programmes. A new licence for those purposes is at an advanced stage of preparation. Similarly, discussions were held with representatives of organisations other than broadcasters who need spectrum for programme-making activities on the means by which their needs might be met by making them responsible, through its association of service providers, for managing a pool of frequencies made available for their purposes. Satellite broadcasting. In the year to April 1987, Radio Communications Division issued 2,000 Wireless Telegraphy Act licences for television receive-only satellite receiving equipment, TVRO. The TVRO licence is confined to the reception of TV or sound radio programmes, forming part of a programme service, intended for ultimate reception by members of the public or by any restricted group or audience. The issue of a licence does not mean that reception is feasible. Reception of television programmes from low-powered telecommunications satellites is not protected from interference from other authorised radio services. In April 1986, the government brought into force sections 37 to 41 of the Cable and Broadcasting Act 1984, enabling the IBA to advertise for a direct broadcast by satellite DBS contract. The IBA announced in December 1986 that British Satellite Broadcasting had been selected for the UK DBS franchise. Throughout the year, Radio Communications Division contributed to discussions on DBS, in particular to international discussions on the Multiplexed Analogue Components, MAC, family of transmission standards for DBS, and to discussions on a draft EEC directive on transmission standards for DBS, adopted in November 1986. Radio Communications Division also participated in national and international exchanges on frequencies and standards for high-definition television.
And a tale of caution reported in Studio Week, the April edition. Audio distributors Don Larking Audio Sales foiled a massive forgery racket last month when it caught one of the perpetrators red-handed. Tipped off by Future Music, which had already been duped to the tune of £5,500, the company was alerted by a suspicious phone call requesting equipment worth £14,000. Larking called the police, who lay in wait for the caller to collect the gear that evening. A young girl turned up in a taxi with a forged Halifax Building Society cheque and was promptly arrested. Larking says the man who made the deal was very evasive and wouldn't leave his telephone number. I knew something wasn't right, but as he was arriving after 5 o'clock when building societies are closed, there was no way I could verify the cheque. Luton-based Audio Sales was almost the tenth in a line of dealers distributors who were taken in by the forgers. Other victims include Psycho and Thatched Cottage. The 17-year-old girl was arrested, was taken to Chiswick police station, where she's been charged with deception and using forged documents. A spokesman for the CID told Studio Week the girl was a runner for a larger organisation. This gang has sent out 30 cheques worth £250,000. However, we're still at the beginning of our inquiries, he said.
Innovative information-based radio, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Facts, the trade station. Number 1, High Ash Farm, K-Store St Edmund, England, NR148RH.
Fun. Yes, we've had our ups and downs. Been down that rocky road, but here we are still around. We thought about someone else, but neither one took the bait. We thought about breaking up, but now we know it's much too late.
A view by Brian West, director of the AIRC, as reported in a recent issue of Sound magazine. PPL monopoly under threat. One outcome of the Copyright Designs and Patents Bill currently before Parliament and the impending Broadcasting Bill to expand radio services in the UK may be the breaking of the monopoly held by Phonographic Performance Limited, or PPL, in the matter of air payment for airplay of records. At least that's what the Association of Independent Radio Contractors, known as the IRC, is hoping for. PPL controls about 95% of the commercial records available in this country, declares AIRC Director Brian West. You can't go elsewhere or have a normal willing buyer selling situation because they hold all the aces. West adds that the AIRC doesn't begrudge a payment for the use of records to the record companies any more than it does to the Performing Rights Society, or the PRS, in copyright fees for the songwriters and music publishers, although it believes the fees are too high. But it resents the take-it-or-leave-it attitude displayed by PPL. Payment is based on a percentage of ILR revenue, says West. The stations achieved a 26.5% growth in the revenue during 1986 and 87 of £25 million, giving a total of £93.9 million for the year ended 30th September last, but with no change in the amount of music played. We're still tied to 9 hours needle time per day. He refutes the PPL argument that ILR is solely dependent on record plays as its staple diet and the generation of its listening figures and earnings. A radio station's revenue can increase as a result of many other reasons apart from the music being played. Our stations have become much more effective on the sales front, and the PPL members are the beneficiaries. Most other commodities purchased in bulk usually bring the buyer a discount, but not in the case of PPL. West also dismisses another charge that high record usage on radio inhibits sales and facilitates illegal home taping. He remarks that only 17% of home taping is done off the air, and the great bulk involves domestic copying of records and tapes. Publicising records on the radio is a positive method of stimulating sales. If it isn't, why do record companies send pluggers around the stations seeking airplay for the records? He estimates PPL's income from record airplay annually to be £9 million to £6 million from the BBC and £3 million from ILR. He adds that the Musicians' Union automatically receives 12.5% of all PPL broadcast royalties. West acknowledges that this money goes into a special fund to support and promote musical events and causes, but terms the arrangements as cosy and a rake-off, initially introduced to buy peace in the recording studios as far as Musician Union members are concerned. Another 20% goes to recording artists and the remainder to the record company members. The AIRC denies advocating the abolition of the broadcasting right in commercial sound recordings, but wishes new legislation will provide equitable remuneration of record companies without allowing them injunctive rights to restrict broadcasters. It also wants the removal of protection under UK copyright law for records originally produced in countries offering no such reciprocal protection for UK-produced records. That was a view by Brian West, who is director of the AIRC, as reported in a recent issue of Sound magazine.
From Electronic Times this week, CD erasure. Thompson of France is to unveil a CD system which can record and erase music on compact discs. Known as magneto-optical disc, MOD, it uses a 12-centimetre disc which can store 45 minutes of music on each side. The disc has an active cobalt iron alloy layer, which can be altered by heat from a 30 milliwatt laser diode and a magnetic field.
Interested in improving AM reception? We will be producing a high-performance synchronous detector circuit board, which is designed to greatly improve reception quality of weak or selectively fading AM signals. The board is designed to accept a 455 GHz IF input at any level, so it will suit most communications receivers. There are two selector switches. The first sets the phase lock loop bandwidth, wide, medium or narrow. Where signals are fading rapidly and the carrier phase changes quickly, or where the carrier is phase modulated with data, as on the various long wave services, then the wider loop characteristics must be used. The second switch has six positions. Position 1 is a low distortion envelope detector. Position 2 is normal double sideband synchronous detection. Position 3 gives upper sideband. And position 4 gives lower sideband. Position 5 is called stereo spread and gives fascinating effects with upper sideband on the left and lower sideband on the right. Position 6 is also unique in giving quadrature, which means that the modulation from the strongest station on the channel is nulled out, so any station beneath can be heard more clearly. Synchronous reception reduces the distortion experienced with a selectively fading signal, but does not help with the objectionable surging in audio level. The final unique feature, then, of this board is that it includes a broadcast quality audio limiter with multiple time constants, which controls the peak audio level. Of course, another benefit of synchronous reception is the signal-to-noise improvement, which results from rejection of noise and interference not in phase with the received signal carrier. The production board will not be ready until July and will be around £150. But if you would like to be on the mailing list for details, send along 1 13-pence British stamp or 1 international reply coupon to Radio Facts, Number 1, High Ash Farm, Case Store St Edmund, England, NR148RH.
In The Independent, there's a report on the monopolies inquiry into TV unions. The government announced an unexpected monopolies commission inquiry into restrictive labour practices in the television and film industry. It is the first time that industrial agreements have been referred to the Commission for such an investigation, and Mr. Fowler, the Secretary of State for Employment, made it clear that he was keen others would follow. He also indicated that if abuses were unearthed, further employment legislation could follow. Mr. Fowler, Lord Young, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, and Douglas Hurd, the Home Secretary, jointly made the reference to the Commission under the hitherto unused Section 79 of the Fair Trading Act 1973. The move could undermine professional closed shops, such as those enjoyed by lawyers and doctors, as well as agreements and covering trade unionists. The Commission has no power other than the power of publication, but employers could take action following a Commission inquiry, and so could the government, Mr. Fowler said. Ministers have been considering invoking the Commission's powers in the television industry since the autumn, when Mrs. Thatcher said in a Downing Street meeting with television chiefs that their industry was the last bastion of restrictive practices. The government, which hopes the report will be published by the end of the year, is apparently trying to undermine the closed shop. Commissioners are called upon to inquire into the extent to which work is restricted to members of certain unions and into whether minimum crewing levels are dictated. The Commission will have to establish whether such practices exist and if they are restrictive under the meaning of the Act. The inquiry will cover ITV companies, the BBC, producers of television commercials, and companies which produce films and film advertisements. The public interest may be affected at the BBC to an even greater extent than elsewhere, Mr. Ridley added. A practical difficulty for the inquiry will be that many of the agreements are arrived at in individual companies. No ITV companies have the same deals on crewing levels. The national agreement is silent on such matters. Mr. Fowler's announcement comes 4 months into a dispute at TVAM in which 229 ACTT members have been sacked. The move also follows the announcement by LWT that 239 of its employees will have to lose their jobs over the next 12 months. Other television companies are also attempting to cut costs. Mr. Fowler said, the elimination of restrictive labour practices is essential to the effective operation of the labour market. The government's policies for competition and changes in industrial relations law have successfully transformed the position in many industries. This reference enables us to reinforce these provisions in an area which still appears to suffer from outmoded restrictions. Mr. Roy Lockett, the Deputy General Secretary of ACTT, the Film and Television Technicians Union, said the reference was an unprecedented attack on free collective bargaining and it was difficult to understand. Well, that was a report by Barry Clement, the Labour correspondent of The Independent.
From this month's Studio Sound, Martin Polon's perspective from America.
If there is anyone in audio who does not know the latest chapter of the continuing saga of DAT versus the copycode filter, we shall recap for you. When we last finished viewing Chapter 68 of this continuing saga of the search for truth, justice, and the American way, the US Congress had turned the matter over to the technical judgment of the United States National Bureau of Standards, NBS. The Bureau's 3,100 employees and $220 million budget is a clear indication of the importance of the work being done at the Gaithersburg, Maryland facility and at Fort Collins, Colorado facility and at other venues as well. The Bureau is the official creator and maintainer of standards for the United States government, and its work has directly contributed to at least three Nobel Prizes. Nonetheless, and despite its well-earned reputation for excellence, the Bureau has had to rely on outside consultants to support the questions validating or invalidating the concepts of copycode, scanning and filtering. The questions being asked are, does the digital copycode scanner system achieve its stated goal of preventing digital audio tape machines from recording when protected pre-recorded material is involved? Does the system of protection encompassing the filtered notch diminish the quality of the pre-recorded material being so protected? Can the copycode system be bypassed, and if so, how easily? The outcome of this research will be used to guide the US Congress in making a final determination on the fate of DAT in the United States. And so hope the record companies, by extension, the rest of the world. However, the pot continues to boil just beneath the surface. Both sides have grudgingly decided that the Bureau will be impartial and is asking the right questions. How well the Bureau can carry out its task with a battery of outside consultants remains to be seen. Many industry experts feel it's not a case of whether the Bureau or its experts are capable of delivering an appropriate degustation as to the relative merits of each side of the copycode issue. Any negative feeling has more to do with the relative shortness of the time frame for this kind of significant study to be done properly. But it seems clear that the Bureau felt threatened in its role as the Congressional Scientific Think Tank and made a measured response to the congressional demand for timely results, as given. The climate in Congress has changed considerably since the original effort was mounted by the RIAA to stop DAT in the fall of 1986. The situation is best summed up by a long-time Washington observer. In 1988, Congress is unlikely to slap a Jap in the yap, no matter what the issue. The outcome of the NBS study can only help Congress avoid a politically touchy situation one way or the other. If the NBS says copycode is innocent of all charges, a deal can be cooked up to substitute a blank tape and machine import royalty for the notch. If the NBS finds copycode guilty as charged, then everybody says, oh well, we tried. The nearly $200 billion in direct and indirect investments made by Japan in the US economy provides a certain degree of leverage in this and a lot of other situations. This is 1988, and it is an election year, and less than 15 days in the first month of the year, Wall Street took another pratfall of 150 points. Pratfall? This is an American expression that does not easily translate across the Atlantic. It describes a sudden and great drop, as one would experience should one's legs be violently removed whilst one's body were in an upright position. No, I don't think we will see any untoward action on DAT. The real threat to the audio and music industries is not the outcome of the NBS study. The threat to be dealt with is the perception of both the record industry and the audio industry that the squabbling over DAT and copycode has left with the music consumer. While one could argue the point that the so-called acoustical hypochondriac has made worrying about the presence of the copycode filter a virtual new category of fetish, right up there with collecting ladies' corsets, the real impact of 18 months of sniping has been far wider. The music industry has precious little time left before the whole issue of copy code and filtering becomes a major topic for the consumer press, newspaper consumer reporters, and television consumer reporters. Once the public perceives the whole issue as a reality, there is virtually nothing that will change that perception except for the passage of time. The time frame for the successful adoption of DAT technology is not as brief a time on this orb of ours as the record companies have suggested. DAT recorders will not be selling for considerably under the $500 price point for some time to come. It seems clear that we will be in the 1990s before DAT recorders even approach the under $500 mark. The decline of the dollar against the yen has created a very unlikely scenario for the traditional knee-of-the-curve price deceleration we have all come to expect of new consumer electronic products. The presence of significant VAT duties on Japanese products reduces the advantage that the EEC member countries have achieved vis-à-vis their currencies and the dollar. All of that, coupled with the existence of a large base of relatively satisfied cassette recorder users, will limit demand, and demand will limit price reduction. The DAT recorder does not fill the classic description of a breakthrough product. It does not perform a new and unique function. Of course, DAT play-only machines are another issue and could drive price reduction in both the record and play-only modes. The demand potential for play-only machines in cars and for portable usage could exceed 50 million units worldwide if pricing is made attractive by the DAT hardware makers. A curious unknown will be the newly recognised potential for hardware makers such as Sony and Philips to use their hardware clout to price DAT players competitively, so as to encourage sales of a newly emergent DAT software catalogue. It's also time to accept the fact that DAT recorder sales have been positively grim in Japan and Western Europe, where consumers have had some real exposure to the product. Reports from Canada are mixed. The problem may be one of expectations. The DAT players we are seeing for the consumer market are still early generation units, with all of the assorted design ramifications that befall a leadership product. The first CD players were accepted as a marvel of new technology, despite some flaws. That level of tolerance of digital innovation is apparently not being extended by prospective buyers to DAT. The reality of digital audio, as it affects the consumer, is also an issue here. Relatively few consumers have purchased sound systems appropriate to the dynamics of the compact disc relative to the large number of CD players sold worldwide. The resulting inability to truly hear the impact of digital technology tends to be self-limiting. The qualitative improvement of the DAT over cassette recording is not going to justify the large price differential for most consumers in the audio mass market. This too will slow adoption of the DAT format. What is so fascinating about the concerted effort the world's record companies and IFPI and RIAA have mounted against DAT is the enormous amount of free publicity that the campaign has engendered for the whole concept of digital audio tape recording. It is as though the well-documented and hard-learned lessons of the pitched battle waged against VCR by the Hollywood movie industry, and specifically by Universal Pictures and Walt Disney Productions over 10 years ago, has been already forgotten in the related campfires of the record industry. The Japanese consumer electronic companies, on the other hand, have learned their lesson well from that previous encounter. The VCR garnered what some analysts listed as close to $1 billion worth of free publicity. It is clear that the concept of DAT has benefited from the current controversy, and that the public's awareness of the technology is significantly higher than if the topic had been ignored.
Now, a city eye view of the cellular phone profits reported by Tom Kite in The Independent on Monday, the 28th of March. A price war is fermenting in the cellular radio sector. Hotly touted as a high technology growth market, Cellular telephones have been responsible a good deal of investment activity among the main players. But the latest signs are that longer-term forecasts may have to be chopped back to allow for a sudden intensification of competition. The two main operators in this market are Vodafone, belonging to Sir Ernest Harrison's Raycor, and Cellnet, a joint venture between British Telecom and Securicor. Price discounts have already become a feature of unit sales. Vodafone was the first to enter the battlefield when it offered a £90 per unit price reduction to dealers. This quickly boosted its market share, and Cellnet decided to enter the fray with a similar rate of price cutting. In neither case, though, did the actual reductions in prices have serious implications for the company's profits. Most of the money derived from the cellular telephones business comes from running networks. As Vodafone and Cellnet eye each other malevolently across the battlefield, they have realised that discounting calls is a more surefire way to achieve the lion's share of network volume. Unfortunately, it's also a surefire way to ensure lower returns. The cost base on operating a cellular network is tiny, which means all the income comes straight through to profits. That also means any price cut inevitably impacts directly on the bottom line. For British Telecom, that may be no big deal. Estimates of BT profits rate cellular phones about fifth down the list. For Securicor and Raycor, it is far more serious, given that results from Cellnet and Vodafone are writ large enough within profits expectations for several years. Raycor is the more exposed, given that its other operations, including defence, data communications and Chubb, look destined to do no more than mark time over the next few years. All the anticipated growth between now and the end of 1988 to 89 is expected to come from Vodafone. Market projections for the year to March 1988 of £137 million pre-tax against £100 million suggest an increase in Vodafone's contribution from £10 million to £45 million. If the discounting of calls is particularly fierce, long and medium-term estimates will fall, and so will Raycor's shares, which at a current premium rate of 221p are on a prospective multiple of 15.9, shareholders should tread warily. That's the view and opinion of Tom Kite from The Independent, Monday 28th of March.
We're on the air to demonstrate the kind of service we will be providing every day of the week, starting during the summer. What we are seeking is a licence to transmit from the United Kingdom instead of hiring transmission facilities abroad. If you would like our specially printed QSL card, please send 50 pence in British stamps or 3 international reply coupons to Radio Fax No. 1, High Ash Farm, Case Store St Edmund, England, NR14 8RH. And don't forget that every letter we receive helps our application for a licence to transmit from England.
From Electronic Times, Fields Unite for First Digital Mobile Phone by Mick McLean. The Libera second-generation cordless telephone launched on Tuesday brings together advanced technologies from the fields of radio, application-specific circuits, microprocessors and software. It has taken 4 years of intensive development by PA Technology and British-based chip makers to bring these technological ingredients to the level of innovation needed to make the world's first digital mobile phone a reality. At the core of the system is the 32 kilobits per second AD-PCM coding technique, which, while fully compatible with the requirements of the public telephone network, provides a consistent transmission quality associated with digital communications. Another key feature of the Libera phone's radio subsystem is its use of a novel time division duplex technique, whereby each 2-millisecond period of speech data is assembled into a 64-bit data packet with 3-channel coded control bits and transmitted at slightly over twice the average data rate. The gap between transmitted packets is filled with a corresponding signal from the phone's fixed base, so transmit and receive signals are interleaved on the same frequency. This approach eliminates the conventional problems of multiplexing the handset's transmitter and receiver to a common antenna. There is no need for a costly diplexer filter, and much of the radio circuitry can be time-shared between transmit and receive functions to cut component and manufacturing costs. At the fixed link, where space is at less of a premium, separate antenna configurations for transmit and receive can be used to reduce the signal degradation caused by multipath propagation. The Libera system operates on 40 channels, each 100 kHz wide, in the 864 to 868 MHz UHF band. Channel selection is based on demand. The sending equipment scans all 40 channels for that with the lowest signal strength and uses this to set up the call. At the other end of the link, the station regularly scans the 40 channels to detect an incoming call. During a call, transmission quality is continuously monitored, and if problems are detected, the phone and its fixed link will switch to another frequency. This autonomous and dynamic spectrum management ensures that the maximum use is made of the limited radio spectrum available. The service is restricted to 10 milliwatts maximum transmit power level, which should give a 50 meter range in such noisy environments as factories, offices or railway stations, and a 200 to 300 meter range in more open spaces. The limited range enables the same 40 channels to be used repeatedly on a cellular basis, thus packing several thousand users into a square kilometer. The channel coding of the three control bits in each data packet is designed to provide sophisticated and rugged protocols capable of ensuring call security and privacy in the three district applications for which the Libera phone is intended: single line, telepoint, and multi-line PABX. In single line operation, the phone works with a fixed base terminal, similar to a conventional cordless phone. But the control protocols of the Libera system enable up to six handsets to be used with a single network connection in a home or private office. In the telepoint system of public access points, anyone within 50 to 100 metres of such a terminal will be able to access the network and have calls billed to the handset's unique identification code. The Libera phone system will also be offered as a flexible and mobile alternative to a conventional PABX in a large organisation. By providing enough fixed links, companies will be able to set up a sophisticated cell phone network within their facilities. Each Libera handset contains a unique identification within its microprocessor memory for security and billing purposes, and personal or corporate owners can also add a selected user code to deter unauthorized access. The Cambridge Laboratory of PA Technology has worked closely with Plessey Semiconductors, Mallard, Ferranti and Texas Instruments to define and develop the low-power CMOS chips required to pack all the second-generation cordless features into a normally sized phone handset. Plessey will make the PA-designed format logic device at the heart of the system, which controls the way digital data are injected and extracted from the radio signal. A second chip, developed by Mallard, looks after the high-speed switching needed for single-frequency operation. Other chips from Ferranti and Texas integrate the phone's audio and speech functions. A standard Texas microprocessor running PA-developed software is responsible for channel selection, identification and security functions, and it also provides call transfer and repertory dialing facilities.
The IBA's annual Attitudes to Broadcasting survey has become an invaluable measure of public opinion about television and radio services, so say Airwaves magazine, which is the quarterly journal of the IBA. And in the report, in this issue, there is a reassuring note perhaps for the ILR stations about alleged bias on independent local radio. The survey reveals that, as in 1986, very few ILR listeners, just 3%, perceived any political favouritism or bias on any independent local radio station. The vast majority in 1987 thought that ILR was usually fair, 83%, with this opinion being more widespread than in 1986, which was 78%. The remainder, 14%, had no particular opinion. Respondents were also asked to give opinions covering ILR's coverage of controversial social or industrial matters. These opinions remained remarkably stable across 1986 and 1987. Once again, 3 out of 4, that's 74%, of those interviewed who had recently listened to or heard any ILR station said they felt the service was usually fair in its treatment of these matters. One in five, 22%, had no opinion, and only a tiny majority, 4%, felt that ILR had at some time been unfair in its treatment of social and industrial controversy. That was a report from Airwaves magazine, the quarterly journal of the IBA.
From Communications Engineering International, March 1988. UK backs Eureka HD TV project. The United Kingdom's Department of Trade and Industry has channelled £2.5 million worth of financial support into a European collaborative project to develop a high-definition television HD TV system. Under the Eureka umbrella, both the BBC and the Independent Broadcasting Authority will benefit from the DTI award, which will help fund a demonstration of an HDTV transmission and reception system at the International Broadcasting Convention in Brighton in September 1988. Further demonstrations will be staged in 1989, with the goal of having the Eureka system accepted as a world standard by the International Radio Consultative Committee, CCIR, in 1990. The aim of the Eureka HDTV initiative is to define an HDTV standard which is in line with the multiplexed analog components MAC transmission system being introduced in Europe. By 1990, the programme aims to have developed and demonstrated a prototype transmission system for MAC-compatible HDTV. Hailed by many manufacturers as a revolutionary step for broadcasting, HDTV uses twice the number of lines compared with standard definition TV, thus enabling the production of TV pictures possessing the quality of 35mm film.
And a report that indicates that perhaps times do not change that much is a headline from a newspaper entitled Lobbyists for Local Radio Fail to See PMG. It reads, "The chances of the Postmaster General, Mr. Wedgwood Benn, accepting the ideas of the Local Radio Association for commercial local broadcasting were, the association's secretary, Mr. John Gorst, agreed yesterday, not very bright. Nothing that emerged in the hour's talking he did at yesterday's press conference went to contradict this pessimistic appraisal. Starting with the declaration that the 100 members of the association were not tycoons, ruthlessly lobbying in pursuit of vast profits, Mr. Gorse drove home this point later by admitting that after 2 years' existence, the association had still not succeeded in getting to see the Postmaster General. The lobbying continues, however. Yesterday, the association's second memorandum on local broadcasting was distributed to all backbench MPs. This repeats and amplifies the arguments for an advertisement finance system of independent local stations and also sets out a frequency plan for 276 local broadcasting stations within the United Kingdom. Mr. Wedgwood Benn has already seen the memorandum and has sent back the message that the arguments it contains will be considered, but he doesn't think a meeting will be useful at the present stage. Mr. Gorse agreed that the opposition to commercial local radio was widespread. The BBC wanted to preserve its monopoly, the independent television companies didn't want further competition, and that there was the prejudice of the culture vultures, the academics. There was as yet no public clamour for local radio, but there was a need. Well, that was written, believe it or not, in the Guardian newspaper on the 9th of June, 1966.
Thank you. goodbye.